Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series, our guests today on the Not Old Better Show are Hannibal Hamlin and Stephen Galbraith. Hannibal Hamlin is a professor of English at The Ohio State University, and Stephen Galbraith is the former Folger Shakespeare Library's curator of rare books. Together, both will provide us a fascinating overview of the dramatic history of English Bible translation, the reformers who shaped the Bible despite opposition from the church, and the Bible's considerable political influence.
No book in any language has ever been printed so often, in so many millions of copies, and distributed so widely around the world as the King James Bible. Where the British Empire went, so went the King James Bible. Where evangelical Christian missionaries went, so went the King James Bible. No book has had a greater influence on the language, literatures, and cultures of English-speaking peoples, especially in the United States. The King James Bible has shaped political oratory from Abraham Lincoln to Barack Obama, and we hear its words and rhythms in the literature of Whitman and Dickinson, Melville and Morrison, Margaret Atwood and Marilyn Robinson.
That, of course, is our guest today, Hannibal Hamlin, who, along with co-presenter Stephen Galbraith, will be at the Smithsonian Associates program presenting a day-long series about the King James Bible, its background, creation, and influence, Saturday, March 17th, 2018, 9:30 a.m. at the Ripley Center in Washington, D.C. Please join me in welcoming to the Not Old Better Show via Skype, Hannibal Hamlin and Stephen Galbraith. Hannibal Hamlin and Stephen Galbraith, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I think this is just a fascinating subject. This is going to be very interesting to our Smithsonian audience. So let's start with that presentation for the Smithsonian Associates coming up. What do you hope, both of you maybe chime in on this, what do you both hope that participants leave after that day? Because it's a full day we're going to be spending with you.
It is. This is Hannibal. I hope they just leave with a richer sense of the sort of long cultural impact of this particular translation of the Bible, which really, I mean, it had an unprecedented influence on language and literatures in English and on American culture and British culture. In a way, the day is almost like a kind of summary of American and British literature and culture.
And Stephen, what do you think?
Well, I'd add to that just by saying, you know, I'd like the participants to come away with the idea that, you know, this is a rich history and it's a very human history. The people involved with translations dating back centuries and the hard work and struggles that went into translations that would lead up to the King James Bible, and then as Hannibal mentioned, and how that language just echoes far into the future.
Well, Stephen Galbraith, let's follow up then on that. And certainly chime in, Hannibal, as well, but did translations change with political influence as it changed?
Sure. You probably in the 16th century is probably where it's or the early 16th century is probably where most of that action's happening. Up until the Great Bible of 1539, you know, to translate the Bible into English is heresy. So the people doing it in the 15th and early 16th centuries are doing it at their own peril. Particularly, we focus on the work of William Tyndale, who is in the 20s and 30s working to create and produce an English translation. And doing so is very, very political. Mm-hmm. And then as the 16th century goes along, yeah, we'll have examples in our seminar about different translations that come out that are different, coming from, you know, Protestant points of view or Catholic points of view, and then also sort of points of view within both of those broader categories.
And if I can chime in, sure. You know, Steve mentioned the importance of these personal stories. I mean, William Tyndale was the great pioneer of English Bible translation, and terribly sadly, he was executed for his pains in 1536. But with heavy irony, just 3 years later, King Henry VIII authorized a full translation into English of the Bible. And I mean, you couldn't find a more political story than Bible translation in those few years.
certainly a powerful book, Hannibal Hamlin. I've read a quote from you that I thought was, it's a sweeping quote, very, very powerful, where you say that the King James Bible has been the most influential book in the English-speaking world for four centuries, and as a result, much of English and American, Canadian, West Indian, Anglo-African, and Australian literature makes less sense without it. Wow. That's powerful. How so?
Well, I mean, there's just, for the most obvious reasons that for most of its history, the main readers of the King James Bible were worshiping, practicing Christians. So this book was at the center of their lives in obvious ways. But the book then shapes all of those Christians who are writers of one sort or another. I've written a lot on William Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare's influenced by earlier English Bibles. But with the King James Bible, certainly by the time you get to John Milton and Paradise Lost or Bunyan and Pilgrim's Progress, it's the King James Bible language that is dominant. And that continues on through the 18th into the 19th and even 20th centuries. Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson, up into Toni Morrison and Marilynne Robinson. If you know the English Bible and you know its particular language, you can recognize it in novels and poems and plays, and it just makes your understanding of these works so much richer.
Give us an
Hannibal,
example.
Hannibal, it's funny you should, oh, I go, was going to say, it's go funny ahead, you Stephen, should yeah. say that, Hannibal, because this morning we were just putting up an exhibition, and I was putting into an exhibition case an edition of Leaves of Grass by Whitman, and was just sort of reading it as we were putting it in. And I thought, oh, we're going to be talking about this language in about an hour.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up. That sets the stage really for both of you. And I guess as a curator, Stephen, you noticed this, but I love that. I personally just love that Walt Whitman Leaves of Grass, Oh Me, Oh My. And maybe, Hannibal, give us an example of that the Oh Me poem, how that might have been influenced by the Bible.
Well, I mean, here's actually, I mean, I can read a bit of mm-hmm. a bit of Whitman.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Thank you.
And really what's key for Whitman is the sort of long rhythmic prose line that you find in the Old Testament prophets in the King James translation. So here, you know, he writes, "Solitary at midnight in my backyard, my thoughts gone from me a long while, walking the old hills of Judea with the beautiful, gentle God by my side, speeding through space, speeding through heaven and the stars, speeding amid the seven satellites and the broad ring and the diameter of 80,000 miles." And of course, on and on he goes, just elaborating that. But I mean, he really, I think, has captured that rhythm from the King James Old Testament and turned it into what he actually thought of, I think, as the kind of new American Bible of Leaves of Grass.
What an honor it was to have you read that. Will you do some of that kind of reading on our day with you with the Smithsonian Associates program?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, you can't stop me.
We don't want to.
I love reading, but it's partly through reading that you really get a sense of this, because, I mean, one of the features of the King James Bible is that it was a Bible designed to be read aloud. So you get it. It's partly that you get this effect in your ear, and then you hear it in the rhythms of Whitman or the lyrics of Dickinson, or, you know, anybody from Milton to Melville and onward.
Let's go back to the kind of the creation of the King James Bible. Who were some of the companies of men, and how were they even chosen for the job?
Steve, do you want to handle this?
Well, if you want to start there, I can maybe talk a little bit about the printing after.
Good, yeah, that'd be great, Steve.
Okay, so what happened? This all came out of a big meeting in 1604 that the newly Queen Elizabeth I died, and King James I came to the throne, and he called a big meeting of all of the leaders of the church to sort of settle church issues and make his own mark. And out of this, I mean, it was a complicated meeting that went on for several days, but one of the things that came out of this was the idea of creating a new translation of the Bible. Though it wasn't, I mean, the idea was never to do something entirely new, but a sort of new and improved. So they would take the best of previous English Bibles and make one that was better. And they assembled a large team. They were all, I think only one of them was not a clergyman. And most of them were the best scholars of ancient languages, ancient history, archaeology, and such from the day. And there were two teams at Oxford University, two teams at Cambridge, and then two teams at Westminster, the Palace of Westminster down the Thames from London. Each of those teams was assigned a portion of the Bible, and the work was just long, slow, and meticulous. These were the most learned men of their day, and they were really interested in getting as close as possible to the original Hebrew and Greek. And so the day's work would, I'm sure, we don't have a lot of data about this, but I think it's safe to say that the day's work would involve wearying discussions about precise vocabulary, which word to use here, how to arrange syntax, and sort of comparing. We know that they compared multiple translations into English and other European languages. They were looking at Greek and Hebrew texts as well as other ancient languages. And so it really was, there's a comment I have no idea who it originates with, but this was the best work ever done by a committee.
And then, Stephen, what about the printing capabilities of the 17th century? I can't imagine, you know, even that, but were they as laboriously undertaken as Hannibal just describes kind of the interpretation portion?
Yeah, actually, I think there's a parallel there, isn't there, Hannibal? Mm-hmm. So after the three committees did their work, they assemble at the Stationers' Hall for a final revision. What's that take, about a year, Hannibal, or so?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and that takes us to about 1610. So, you know, as Hannibal said, it starts around 1604, this whole process, so you can get a sense of the length. At that point, it gets the person in charge of printing would be Robert Barker, and if you were lucky enough to be the printer who had the royal patent to do English Bibles, you get that job. Except it was a pretty colossal undertaking. So he had to, first you have to raise a lot of money for the paper. That's the most expensive part of the printing process at this time. They get the paper in advance. To do that, it seems from the records that he takes on a couple co-publishers, and this ends up being, in the long run, a bad thing. So the money is all on them, not as I think Hannibal once said, you know, this is the perfect example of the government maybe putting a project out there but not paying for it. but it falls on the printer. Over the course of about a year, they print the Bible. It may be estimates between, you know, 500 and latest census maybe puts it at 1,500 copies. So maybe we could say about 1,000 copies to be safe. Mm. And it's released in 1611. But because it was so expensive, Robert Barker and his co-publishers end up in court battles through almost the rest of their lives. Robert Barker ends up dying in debtor's prison. And it's one of the stories we'll tell on the 17th.
Well, these will be excellent stories to hear from you, Hannibal Hamlin and Stephen Galbraith. Thanks so much for joining us today. It's just a pleasure to talk to you. This is a great program, and I think it is worth spending an entire day on. I just encourage my audience to go and check this out. Thank you guys very much for joining me today.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. My thanks to our guest today, Hannibal Hamlin, who, along with co-presenter Stephen Galbraith, will be at the Smithsonian Associates program presenting a day-long series about the King James Bible, its background, creation, and influence, Saturday, March 17th, 2018. My thanks as well to the Smithsonian team for all they do to support our interviews. As usual, we'll post links to everything, and also, as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me. I am always interested in your feedback, and you can leave it at iTunes, Google Play, or send me email directly at info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about better. The Not Old Better Show. Thanks, everybody.